Well, hello and welcome to the Mariner's Library with me, Chris Stanmore Major. And in this episode, we're continuing the book, The Search for Captain Slocum, by Walter Magnus Teller. We're on chapter 23, and this is the 17th part of the reading. And if you haven't already, please consider going over to patreon.com/themariner to help support the podcast, or you can check out the Mariner podcast with all things sailing and seamanship each week, or of course, the Mariner YouTube channel, where you can see gear reviews, how-to videos, and me engaged in expeditions and projects all over the world. Now on with the story. Chapter 23. You must then know the sea, and know that you know it, and not forget that it was made to be sailed over. As Slocum approached the end of his life, he became more disassociated, more irascible, less communicative. The fixed points became fewer. It is as though actuality were slipping from his grasp. As writer too, he had passed the peak and was sliding down the farther side. After the successful serialization of Sailing Alone, he naturally tried to sell to the Century again. Even before the appearance of his book, he was corresponding with Boole about a piece on the South Sea pirate Bully Hayes. Of all the buccaneers and pirates of my acquaintance, Captain, Pirate Hayes had the most winning ways. He was very taking, Slocum wrote. He promised to send an outline, but if he did, Boole did not buy it. In book form, Sailing Alone did well, and as early as 1902 was in its third printing. Sales were approaching the 10,000 mark. In April of that year, Slocum and Boole discussed the idea of a new edition of Voyage of the Liberdad. However, Boole had several complaints about it. Slocum replied, "I will strengthen human sympathy in it as I go along on the next trip through the Magellan Straits with a pilot on board." But the Century Company did not reissue the story, and nor has any American publisher done so. In the wake of the success of Sailing Alone, the captain sold his earlier writing. As already noted, The Voyage of the Destroyer was bought by McClure's magazine and appeared in March 1900. After the Century rejected Voyage of the Liberdad, Slocum sold it to Outing magazine. It was published November 1902 to April 1903 as Voyage of the Aquidneck. Now he disposed of the last of his literary wares, the notes on Bully Hayes. In March 1906, Outing magazine published Bully Hayes, The Last Buccaneer, the byline written from data supplied by Captain Joshua Slocum. In this ghost-written piece, there is scarcely a phrase with the true Slocum flavour. It was strictly a commercial transaction. Outing bought and published, discrepancies and all. Slocum never could write the piece because he had no important connection with the subject. His one contribution to Hayes was not in the data, but in a letter to Boole. "I have seen no one resemble him in portrait more than John Ruskin." Just as the captain admired professors like Langley and Mason, so he admired freebooters like Morgan and Hayes. He himself shared the conquistador qualities of mind required for outstanding performance in either profession. With a little difference in luck, he might have been one or the other. The success of his book had not been able to wrench him away from the old life. By autumn of 1906, he was wandering again. The family genealogist wanted to get hold of him to get him to fill out a questionnaire. From Block Island, in the province of Rhode Island, 15th November, Slocum wrote briefly, "My mails have not reached me on time of late. I regret that I have not been able to be, myself, a better subject among my kin, to have added an interesting line." The captain sailed south again, alone again, and spent a second winter in the Cayman Islands. When spring returned, he set his white wings for the north. From the banks of the Potomac, foot of 7th Street, 26th May, 1907, he wrote B. Amar, "I was glad to get your letter. I am going ahead some again, with a vessel full of stuff worth something. The President sent down for me yesterday to meet him in the Red Room, White House. Archie came and brought me in their market wagon. Archie will join me again at Oyster Bay. You must find time to meet us. Your father, Joshua Slocum." The story is told that when the captain shook hands with the president in the White House, Mr. Roosevelt said, "Captain, our adventures have been a little different." And the captain said, "That is true, Mr. President, but I see you got here first." Archibald Roosevelt reported that his father took a great interest in Slocum, as he did in all adventurous men, and entertained him at home rather than at the office. I remember that my father rang for the butler, a wonderful old man named Duncan, and ordered a rum drink for the captain. When the captain protested, my father explained that as he was only a president, while the captain was a real captain, he, the captain, would have to drink for both of them. After the visit, I rode back to the Navy Yard with Slocum, and he said to me, "My head is just humming from that drink." It was only years later that I found out that he was practically a teetotaler. From Washington, Slocum sailed to Oyster Bay with his cargo of forest orchids, coral, curiosities, souvenirs, and books. When he arrived in June, it was a busy and popular place. The presidential yacht was moored at the harbour entrance. Overlooking the harbour was Sagamore Hill, the summer White House. He anchored alongside a Sandy Hook pilot boat owned by a young man, Stanley Putney Morris. Morris recalled that he'd helped tow the Spray into nearby harbours, where the captain gave talks to various groups and sold and autographed a lot of books. He had a very nice Columbia phonograph and would play records and spin yarns. Slocum waited around Oyster Bay for young Archibald. They were planning a second trip together. Once a year, sea-battered, kindly old Captain Joshua Slocum puts in the harbour here with his weather-beaten, snub-nosed, tight little yawl, the Spray, to see his chum, Archie Roosevelt. The two are fast friends, and they are preparing to start Monday for a cruise along the New England coast, reported the New York World, 13th of July. But somehow, they did not get started. So the captain sailed alone for Martha's Vineyard and reached Cottage City, Oak Bluffs, at the height of the tourist season. He soon got together a little crew to help him unload. One of his former hands said she was a girl of 12 when she met the captain in the summer of 1907. His boat was tied up at the wharf, she wrote, and my girl chum and I were fascinated with the sponges, shells, and odd things he had for sale. He was friendly and told us all about them. When he found that we were at the Frazier House, just over the rise, he asked us if we would like to sell his little souvenir books, shells, etc. We were delighted. We learned the stories and where the articles came from and how to blow the shells for customers, as the captain did when he needed a foghorn. He was very much pleased with our work and paid us well and was kind to us always. Before he sailed south a third time alone, the captain boarded a train and went from Boston to Groton. He turned up on a Sunday to call on my brother Kermit and me, Archibald Roosevelt wrote. Groton was a strict Episcopalian school, and the captain, like the other guests, was expected to attend chapel and afterwards to shake hands with the rector, which he did. The Roosevelt boy stood by his friend while the rector politely asked how the visitor enjoyed the service. "Well," replied the captain, who had very personal ideas on communion with his Maker, "there was too much popping up and setting down and too much sassing back." When Slocum set sail in the autumn of 1907, his intention was to go to South America. However, he knew that his Menemsha friend, Ernest Dean, was in the Bahamas working as captain of a yacht. Slocum decided to surprise him. One day, he simply turned up in Nassau Harbour. "As soon as the port doctor left," Dean wrote, "I had one of my sailors row me alongside, and when Slocum recognised me, he let out a loud, 'Come aboard!' grabbed me by the arms and fairly swung me up on deck. I was amazed, and still am, at his strength." In Nassau, the old sailor showman made one of his last appearances on the platform. Dean recalled it as a soup and fish affair at the Colonial Hotel. The governor and his staff attended, and after the talk, the captain was kept busy telling more yarns in the grill, where the men, according to Dean, became hilarious and liberal. The captain went away $460 to the good. A few nights later, he gave his talk in a church for an admission fee and took in $42. Dean recalled a further incident of the captain's visit. It showed how thin-skinned Slocum had become. Dean said he was walking on Bay Street when he saw the sloop lying alongside a sponge wharf and four or five natives standing in a group and Slocum standing between them and the edge of the wharf. One native was holding a cloth over his mouth, which was bleeding. Slocum, Dean wrote, seemed all nerved up. I asked him what had happened, and here is his reply. "I was splicing some rigging on deck when they came along, ginned up some, and started talking about the Spray and her size and running her down in general. One of them said loud enough for anyone to hear, 'Any man that says he sailed around the world in that thing is a goddamn liar.' I looked up in time to see which one said it, made a pierhead leap, and with a couple of sidewinders, unshipped his jaw. Late in the following spring, on the 11th of May 1908, Hetty wrote her husband's friend, Boole. She said she had read that the spray had been lost. Personally, have not heard from Captain Slocum since November the 1st, 1907. Will you kindly let me know if you have heard from him or of him of late? But Boole had had no word either. On the 2nd of June, the seemingly unsinkable captain sailed into New York Harbour with a 2-ton chunk of coral on board for the American Museum of Natural History. It had been found by scientists off Andros Island in the Bahamas, and they had engaged the ex-merchantman to transport it to the United States. It was the 10th anniversary of the return of the spray. Though Slocum was undoubtedly pleased to have shipped a cargo once again, he had left the West Indies in a huff. He had heard remarks among the governor's staff which were, or which he thought were, uncomplimentary to the spray and himself. So when the governor asked to see the coral he was taking out of the country, so to speak, Slocum did not comply. Instead, when ready to leave, he beat the spray up to the channel entrance buoy, directly below the hill on which the governor's residence stood. Then, swinging the spray off before the wind, he presented the governor with a fine view of her broad stern. In his heightened state of exasperation, he was making the nautical equivalent of a vulgar gesture. Holding his course, Slocum ran Nassau out of sight. At the time of delivering the coral, Captain Slocum presented the museum with a gift from himself, a wooden shield from North Queensland, Australia. Had he picked it up on the voyage around, or had it belonged to Virginia? It is still in the museum's collection, but the 2-ton coral, like the Libertad, has mysteriously dropped out of sight. From New York, the captain went back to Martha's Vineyard, but not to live in West Tisbury. From the spray, tied up at Vineyard Haven, 23rd of July, charmed and charming as always when dealing with the learned, he wrote the director of the museum a gracious letter. I am more than pleased with the thought of having the picture in the spray library, and it shall, together with your letter, find a prominent place in this part of the old sloop where treasures are to be found. By now the captain in his adopted town was recognised as the transient he was. On the 30th of July, the Vineyard Gazette reported, Captain Joshua Slocum of the sloop Spray is on the island and has been a recent guest of Mrs. Slocum at West Tisbury. Slocum is mentioned only twice again in the Vineyard Gazette in his lifetime. On both occasions, he was reported on the move. The last time Archibald Roosevelt saw Slocum was in Oyster Bay again, in cooler weather, probably late in 1908. The Sylph was taking my father and the family to some function or other, he wrote, and had just weighed anchor and was rounding the lighthouse when we saw the spray beating into the harbour. Of course, the men were all busy and failed for several minutes to see that the spray had dipped her flag in salute to the president. When we returned and called on the spray, the captain of the Sylph apologised and gave as an excuse the explanation that they were so busy. Captain Slocum laughed. I held those halyards till I thought my hands would freeze. There were 50 men on the Sylph and one on the spray, but evidently that one can get things done on time. Around 1908, H.S. Smith, a youthful yachtsman, paid the usual admission fee and went aboard the spray in New Bedford. He explored her thoroughly. On going below, he found many evidences of serious deterioration, he wrote. Smith and his companions went for a sail with the captain. We were all allowed a trick at the wheel, Smith said, and I was amazed at the old tub's easy steering and her dryness. There was a strong southwesterly blowing which raised the usual Buzzard's Bay chop, but not a drop of water came aboard, and she sailed at a remarkably small angle of heel. Also, once sheets had been properly trimmed, she would steer herself for an indefinite time, to such an extent that a trick at the wheel was rather monotonous and somewhat unnecessary. Smith described Slocum as wearing a battered felt hat, originally black but bleached out irregularly, a collarless shirt, a vest, unbuttoned trousers and high lace-up shoes, badly in need of polish. The captain volunteered little information but readily answered questions. His language was that of a cultured gentleman, Smith said, and he spoke rather vaguely of a possible voyage down the east coast of South America. But, Smith added, the spray was dirty. Not just a little dirty, but very, very dirty. He said that the captain was much run down physically, and perhaps mentally, and that he was exceedingly indifferent to his surroundings. He was like some condemned old craft. Joseph Conrad's one-time chief mate, Mr. B, said in Sydney, "Ports are no good, ships rot and men go to the devil." But this was only part of the trouble with Slocum. He was clearly in a state of general fatigue. His energies, too generously used, had by now been exhausted, or at least overstrained. Chapter 24. I was born in the breezes, and I had studied the sea as perhaps few men have studied it, neglecting all else. West Tisbury now lost all its charms. From Quincy, Massachusetts, 4th of September, 1909, Slocum wrote Victor. Your letter was received just as I was leaving West Tisbury. We are pulling out of it for the winter at least, and would sell if a purchaser should turn up. The little place you speak of is unoccupied. I think no one will live on the road this winter except Sam West, whom you know. It would be all very nice in summer. I am on the spray, hustling for a dollar. Just where I will be next, I don't know. The captain, 65 years old, was getting ready to embark on a wildly sensational scheme of exploration. His idea was to sail to South America and enter the Orinoco River. Sailing up the Orinoco, he would try to proceed into the Rio Negro, thence to the headwaters of the Amazon, then down that long unknown course to the Western Ocean, and that way home. He was planning to go alone, as usual, but taking his phonograph so that should some Indians take him for a god, he would be able to set up in business. It will be recalled that he owned a copy of Henry Walter Bates, The Naturalist on the Amazons. To get ready, he took the spray to Bristol, Rhode Island, to the famed Herreshoff Works. Victor wrote that the spray was overhauled there, and that when she left, she was well fitted and provided for. The captain, he wrote, was in the best of physical health. Victor, however, was not on the scene. Mr. L. Francis Herreshoff was, and he wrote, "The spray did not have any work done on her at the Herreshoff Company, but simply lay at one of their wharves in what is called Walker's Cove. She may have been given some old ropes, but the captain did everything himself in the refit. In my opinion, the spray was a poor boat for single-handed cruising. Some of her gear was very light and weak. I shouldn't be surprised if I were the last one to speak to the captain, for I saw him off on the morning that he departed." But he was not the last, because Bristol was not the captain's last landfall. There are several other candidates for the honour. Captain Ernest Mayhew of Menemshire said he was the last man but one to see Slocum, because he had followed him out of Menemshire Basin when Slocum started on his last voyage, and that he had seen him head south-southeast. Captain Mayhew added that he thought Slocum had been getting slack, that just before he sailed, the spray had been moored by two stakes, that high tide had lifted her bowsprit onto one of the stakes, and that when the tide fell, the bowsprit was hung up on the stake and lifted several inches. Captain Mayhew said he saw Slocum take an axe and drive the bowsprit back into place, and that he, Mayhew, had not thought much of that. Others noted with concern the spray's condition. Slocum's friend, Dean, wrote, "The captain grew slack in keeping her up. When I first met him and the spray, they were both neat, trim, and seaworthy. But as the years rolled along, I noticed signs of wear and exposure." Captain Donald L. Poole of Chilmark said her rigging was slack and in need of tarring, and Irish pennants were much in evidence. Irish pennants are loose ends hanging about the sails or rigging. From Menemshire, Slocum sailed to Vineyard Haven. On the 14th of November 1909, he set sail again, outward bound, and alone. But he does not seem to have made his port of call. The old sailor and his boat, lover and beloved, left the visible world together, and no trace of either ever has been found. Captain Levi Jackson of Edgartown said he was coming in from cod fishing off the Muscogee Channel shoals between Martha's Vineyard and Nantucket in his boat, the Priscilla, when he saw the spray bound out. He said that at the time he remarked it looked bad for a boat without power to be heading southeast. The wind was coming from that direction, and by evening it was blowing a gale. Captain Jackson said he was glad to get home that night because during the night the gale hauled northwest, making a heavy cross sea. He said he believed it was the same wind coming back, that such storms are not uncommon, and that they whip up great combers over the shoals. Francis V. Meade of Boston wrote that he believed that he and Captain John Randolph of Cottage City, fishing in Muscoquite Channel, were the last to see Slocum. B.H. Kidder of Oak Bluffs claimed that he saw Slocum still later at Bridgeport, Connecticut, that he asked him where he was heading for and that Slocum replied, "Some faraway places." There were, and are, of course, all sorts of theories as to what might have happened. Victor, in his book, favoured the idea that with her dim, oil-burning, running sidelights, the spray was cut down in the shipping lanes she would have to cross, heading south. T.F. Day, editor of The Rudder magazine, guessed that the sloop spewed a plank. He described her as considerably dozy the last time he saw her. Then there is always the possibility of collision, or fire at sea, or of a sailor falling, or being washed over the side. Some have said that Slocum simply played out, others that he perished of fever far up the Amazon. There were rumours of his having been seen and reported by steamships. No one apparently has suggested, perhaps because no one has known heretofore of the captain's occasional lapses of memory, that he might have suffered another spell, might have blacked out, and thus been unable to guide the spray through the night. There is no need to choose or accept any one of these theories. A combination of causes may have led to the ultimate effect. Hetty's petition to the court several years later said that Joshua Slocum disappeared, absconded, and absented himself on the 14th day of November, A.D. 1909. That said absentee, a master mariner by occupation, disappeared on the date above named under the following circumstances, to wit, he sailed from Tisbury, Massachusetts, in the sloop Spray, of about 9 tons burden only, encountered a very severe gale shortly afterwards, and has never been heard from since. It is by no means unthinkable, or even ironical, that Slocum, after going all the way by water, was very likely lost close to land. In spite of all hazards, it is better for the sailor to be on the open sea than skirting the treacherous shore. Slocum himself, in sailing alone, described how the closest call in all his vast voyaging came on a trip across a lagoon in a squall. Whatever the conclusion is to be, the gale, as Captain Jackson described it, must be considered, and the shoals on which the sloop could have tripped and foundered. Also the condition of the aging spray. Even in the early days of her rejuvenation, wrote a contemporary, she was not of the strongest, being built out of whatever came to hand and cost least. Most of all, the condition of the captain must be kept in mind. A fatalist, as men who have lived long with danger are wont to be, he seems to have sailed in defiance of the southeast gale breeding that day. For men like Slocum, the joy of living was in taking the helm and in steering in the teeth of the blow. Still, the voyage is not all up to the sailor, but also up to the wind and the currents, and to the wisdom of the impenetrable being which the sailor knows truly exists because he sees it in the beauty and the mystery of the sea. Every man tends to get more or less what he wants. And at that point, what was it Slocum wanted? Space, escape, adventure, danger, self-destruction, God, love, they all seem possible. His decision to sail, when and as he did, could have been his way towards his goal. Garfield said that his father told him that he hoped to be buried at sea. Hope could have turned to longing, longing unconsciously to impulse. And Slocum was impulsive. It is not what he felt or thought. We have all had such feelings and thoughts, but his acting it out that makes him different. The true seafaring man does not fear being lost at sea. For such men, the sea will be all sufficient. Joshua Slocum had entered on it in his youth, had spent the vigour of his manhood battling its winds and waves for a living, and in fact, all his best thoughts and feelings seemed to have been of the ocean. What then more natural at the end than that he should lie till eternity in the element which, in his life, he had loved and fought and cajoled and outwitted? Slocum's finish, though dramatic and wonderfully fitting, could, of course, have been merely an accident, long overdue, in which one seeks vainly for meaning. For men like Slocum, the sea is a jealous mistress, and never really to be trusted. But he made his home with her, for, in the last analysis, her hold on him was too great to be shaken. He answered the poet's question, "Who hath desired the sea?" Quite some time passed before his performance was wholly accepted and made final. On the 15th of January 1924, the court granted Hetty whatever her husband left behind. Captain Joshua Slocum was declared legally dead as of the date on which he last set sail. Chapter 25. In such a time as this, the old fisherman prayed, "Remember, Lord, my ship is so small, and thy sea is so wide." Inspired by Slocum, a dozen men and more have sailed around the world since, some single-handed, some in boats smaller than the Spray, but none has made the voyage he made, and none has written a book like his. With the passing of time, his achievements will loom still larger. Everything ultimately contributed to the design. Early hardship, the climb to fortune, the plunge to disaster, the long descent to fame. Slocum was better fitted and worth more for single-handed sailing and writing about it afterwards than for anything else in the world. His genius was to find it out. The story of Joshua Slocum is a story of faithfulness to calling. The happiness he knew was the happiness of pursuit. In the classical manner of all adventurers, he began life by leaving home. He chose a lonely mode of existence, but the sea filled the hollow left by affection denied. Later, for a few years, he found the perfect companion, but when she died, he was left even more alone than before. The son of a case-hardened father, Slocum, in turn, seems to have been much the same. His parental domestic code, like his sexual one, was harshly puritanical. Like all views of life successfully imposed, his involved sacrifice not only of himself, but of wife, children, and all that most men hold dear. In our time, it is generally known, as it was not in his, that man is not a wholly rational and consciously motivated being, that though motives may be obscure, a plausible reason for behaviour can almost always be found. But reason does not exist outside a context of desire, and as yet, no limit has been found to man's capacity for self-deception. Slocum's passions were fierce, but his repressions even fiercer. He was one of that vanishing breed, an honest self-deceiver. His self-deception was massive and creative. He strove for harmony and peace, but found them only in the heart of action. Though often outwardly serene, to the end of his life he was driven by that human discontent and restlessness which underlie all great achievement. A kind of prophet of the value of insecurity, he finally sailed away from a world in which he could find no place. Men who follow the sea, particularly those who spend days and months and years at sea and without companionship, tend to think things through to a philosophy not easily explained. Such a life suckles a type of man, ingrown perhaps, but firm in his belief in himself and in God, supremely confident, but truly humble before the Lord on the great waters, purposeful and tenacious when once the course is charted, and above all, determined to go as his own beliefs lead him. In such men, there is affirmation as well as adventure. Impelled by the invisible hand, listening only to the inner voice, Slocum discovered and gained a world with flavour and meaning and enjoyment. The story of his life, like the story of his sailing alone, belongs to mankind. May it take its place in the annals of the human race, and so the search is ended. Well, that's the end of The Search for Captain Slocum by Walter Magnus Teller. I hope you've enjoyed listening to it as much as I've enjoyed reading it for you. Next episode in the Mariner's Library, we'll be starting a new book. But until then, if you haven't already, please consider going over to patreon.com/themariner, supporting the podcast, and then we can keep securing this knowledge for future generations. But for now, wherever you are and whatever you're doing, I hope that you are safe and sound, and I look forward to catching up with you again in the next episode of The Mariner's Library.